This is the IBJ podcast for the week of July 6th, 2020, brought to you by the law firm Krieg DeVault. I'm Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. I am recording this introduction on Thursday, July 2nd. By the way, hope you had a great 4th of July weekend. So we know that although it feels like we've been living in pandemic conditions for about a year, it's only been about 4 months since this began to feel real for most people. And we know that we're not going to be free of this mess anytime soon. Tens of millions of people have lost their jobs or taken significant pay cuts. The federal government has pushed out trillions of dollars in relief in the form of direct taxpayer stimulus, beefed up unemployment aid, grants for keeping small businesses afloat, and other strategies. Congress is expected to get working on another big relief package when it gets back to work in a couple of weeks. Meanwhile, we're still trying to figure out how to get kids back to school safely, while some of us, adults, begin to return to our workplaces. Just this week, reopening plans in several states were pushed back due to spikes in COVID-19 infections. Through it all, the true extent of the economic fallout is still unknown. Now, to get a sense of what people are talking about at their dinner table and worrying about as they try to fall asleep at night, I called personal finance guru and IBJ columnist Pete Dunne, aka Pete the Planner. He's in the relatively unique position of being privy to the financial lives of hundreds of families as advisors from his services, Your Money Line and Hey Money, help folks through their financial problems. And to the extent that we can know what's coming, Pete is particularly concerned about a big milestone at the end of this month. Here's our conversation. Joining me in the IBJ podcast virtual studio is Pete Dunne, aka Pete the Planner. Pete, it is great to see you again.
Mason, it's good to see you through the high quality connection of our cameras in a Zoom room.
Yeah, and the foreshortening in our faces is weird. We both have abnormally large noses, strangely.
I love it.
So we last spoke 16 weeks ago, which feels like it was about a year ago. And I don't know if you remember, but we did our last podcast interview on the morning of Thursday, March the 12th, which we now know as Black Thursday.
It's funny. It's when I have been talking about what's been going on over the last 16 weeks or so, I mention March 12th as the day I knew we were in big trouble. So for you to tell me that right now sends a little some chills down the spine, if I'm being honest.
Well, just to remind everybody, so the Dow plunged about 10% for its worst day since the crash of 1987. Now, what is phenomenal, since I've gone back and I've reviewed that interview, as you essentially predicted, the stock market bounced back pretty quickly. It's back to a point, at least for the moment, where it's only 3 or 4% off from where we started on January the 1st. But as we try to say as frequently as we can, the stock market is not the economy.
Yeah, it really isn't. And, you know, we always try to look for a precedent of like what's going to happen. And of course, if you listen to any commercial or read any ad copy in the last 16 weeks, you will realize we are in unprecedented times. However, there's always a precedent for the stock market. And it always says that the market will be fine. Mason, I've dug into this a little bit, as you would hope, since you asked me to do this, and you thought, well, he'll be prepared. I am. Since World War II, there have been 26 market corrections. Now, a market correction is between 10% loss and 20% loss from the high. So between 10 to 20 down from the highs, there have been 26 of those. The average time of recovery back to the high is 4 months. 4 months. Now, you will say, because you studied this stuff, Mason, you will say, Pete, this was not a correction. This was worse because we were down 37% from the high. Therefore, we were in a bear market. Mason, the average period of time to recover from a bear market is about 4.4 years, and we've done it in roughly 3 months. So that is to say, I'm never worried about the market. It recovered in 3 months instead of 4.4 years. And so that's why I think the bigger issue is the economy, because we're looking at recessionary times, we're looking at recovery times, we're looking at unemployment rates, and how does all of that coincide with the rise or fall of this horrible infectious disease, which is riling everyone.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, inevitably when you talk about the economy, people are just thinking about their personal economies. And you have obviously, you know, a very clear view into what people are thinking about and what they're worried about. So tell me, what are your clients right now? What problems are they dealing with?
We always separate this question into threes because it's important to look through the right lens. So there are three groups of people listening right now. There are three groups of people in your neighborhood and everywhere around you. There's people who've been greatly impacted by this shutdown from an income and employment standpoint. So let's just call those group one if we can throughout the interview. Group two are people who've not been impacted yet, but don't have stability. They do not have an emergency fund. They don't have a backup plan. If the trend continues, they're going to end up in group one. And then there's group three. Group three are people who have no income or employment issues, and they have stability. They have a full emergency fund. So to your question, where are we? Well, I would say roughly 25 to 30% of the calls we're getting and people we're dealing with are in group one that have been greatly impacted, and it is a triage situation. We're talking about breaking every personal finance idiom and rule that ever existed just to save the bacon. All right, so that's group one. Group two, I'd say it's about 60 to 65% of people. It is the middle class. It is an ever-growing definition of the middle class because it really sucks some families in that are making, you know, $150,000, $200,000 a year, but tens of thousands of dollars of that income is incentive-based, bonuses, commissions, those sorts of things, which have virtually disappeared. And then you get about 10% of our calls and our people we talk to. How do I responsibly and appropriately take advantage of this situation to further improve my financial stability? And that sounds gross to say, but there's really nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. So group one, the triage situation, what do you mostly find yourself advising these folks to do?
It's survival. I think too often, we put pressure on ourselves to say, this will define our character. And, you know, we're going to tell our kid, no, just relax, take a breath. And you're just trying to survive. You're trying to not liquidate your 401k. You're trying not to liquidate your IRA. I'd rather you go into small amounts of consumer debt in order to get through this, as opposed to liquidate your future. Because if you liquidate your future, this problem becomes much worse, because then not only do you have short-term instability, but you instantly have long-term instability as well. So that's the first thing that we see with group one, is just we're encouraging people to break rules. We're encouraging people to get out in front of their inability to pay rent or their mortgage and to have those conversations. But we're also a little afraid, based on unemployment enhancement of $600 a week, that some people in group one have been lulled into comfort, and that comfort's about to get ripped away in the next few weeks.
Why do you say that?
Well, the unemployment enhancement based on the CARES Act ends. So that $600 a week enhancement goes away, and I'll do the math for you. That's roughly $2,400 a month of income for an unemployed person that's going away. And so they still may receive state unemployment benefits, but that additional $600, which has gotten a lot of people by, goes away. That scares me as much as anything now. I'm trying not to be an alarmist on this particular day. But the thing that scares me the most right now, short of the virus itself, is what happens at the end of July, what happens at the beginning of August, when the well runs dry for unemployment, because I don't have a lot of confidence that Congress is going to come together and extend that particular program.
So these people in group one, are most of them in danger of losing their housing? Or do they have resources, like you mentioned, just like things that you shouldn't touch, like 401ks, that you potentially could?
That's a tough question. You've got me in a bind here, because I'm debating myself. Under normal circumstances, they would absolutely be in trouble in terms of evictions, foreclosures, all those sorts of things. But you are seeing some government mandates that prevent some of those processes. You're seeing relief from the CARES Act in the form of the FHA forbearance program that allows people to put off a mortgage payment for 12 months if they're in trouble, if they have a federally backed mortgage. So yes, you will see some homelessness as it relates to this. And I'm actually slightly ashamed that I used that voice change there, but it's sad. It's the sad reality that if this was not a pandemic, and we do run into these times from time, you know, on occasion, we would have major housing insecurity issues in our country. And I do think we're going to have some of that going forward.
The folks in group two, what tends to be the takeaway for them when your advisors speak with them?
All right. So this is anecdotal, but that's why you have me on to tell you that. See, to tell you what we see talking to thousands of people. And I think that's important to point out. My organization is a group of professional financial problem solvers that get to people through their employers. We're an employee benefit. So we have literally talked to thousands of individuals since you and I last spoke on March 12th. So that's to say we have a quite the abundance of case studies here. I would say in this group, you've got a lot of people that frankly are putting the cart before the horse. They're saying, nothing's bad happened to me. Now, how do I take advantage of this situation? Now, if you remember correctly, about 5 minutes ago, I said that's what group three is doing and should do. Group two should not do that. Group two should seek stability. They should make minimum payments on their credit cards in order to build a hardier emergency fund. They should cut spending dramatically, even if that makes someone uncomfortable and it makes them feel like scarcity is a big part of their life, in order to build that stability. Because if you're in group two, you're only going one of two ways. You're going to find your way into group one, or you're going to work yourself into group three by getting that stability. Because the threshold to get into stability in group three is simply to have 3 months, simply have 3 months' expenses set aside. And Mason, as you may well know, that can take people years to do. However, usually there's not the pressure of this time. The temperature is so turned up right now. I think a person can motivate themselves to get into group three by changing behaviors and rise to the occasion.
So if I have 3 months of expenses set aside, you consider me in group three?
If you have 3 months expenses set aside and you have not had income loss, household income loss of 25% or more, I would view you to be in group three, which, you know, it doesn't mean you're rich or you're wealthy or you're the 1%. It just means that whatever happens in the next 6 months isn't likely to take you down.
I mean, again, we're dealing with a specific section of the population, but how many people or what percentage of people that you're speaking with have lost their jobs?
We've seen big swaths. I'd say 25%, if not 25 to 35%, and that extra 10% is major income loss. So I think for the IBJ audience, I think there's something interesting because you've got really well compensated people that you know consume the news through the Indianapolis Business Journal. And oftentimes part of that compensation comes in the form of incentive comp or bonus or commission or something like that. That is the great equalizer in this time because those opportunities are going away. A few weeks ago, I guess, my IBJ column was about a woman in Zionsville who wrote me an email that said her base income is 75 grand a year, but she was typically making $200,000 a year because of incentive comp. But she had realized that she was not going to get that incentive comp. She was not going to get the additional $125,000. And she was panicking because she didn't use that high income to create stability in her life. She'd always used it to create comfort. And so I think what a lot of people are learning is you can take comfort in your lifestyle, but it's not stability. You can say, well, I don't feel stressed. We can do the things we want. We've got a lot of discretionary income. But when that income, which isn't your base income, goes away, stability's not there to support you. And sadly, I think we're going to see a lot more of that. The bonuses that have become, oh, we're used to that, or it's 20% of my comp, or you know, 50% of my comp. Those are going to go away, and that's going to last. That the impact of that's going to last a long time.
Okay, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
The IBJ Podcast is brought to you by Creek DeVault, a trusted and dynamic law firm representing a wide variety of local, regional, and national clients. Committed to each other and to every client, Creek DeVault prides itself on integrity, professionalism, respect, and excellence. Financial institutions, global manufacturers, national healthcare providers, and successful organizations of all sizes and market focus rely on Creek DeVault to create innovative and successful business solutions. Connect today at www.creekdevault.com.
All All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ Podcast. We're catching up with financial guru Pete the Planner about the challenges his clients have been facing during the pandemic. Measuring on a scale of 1 to 10, what is the level of anxiety?
It's worth noting, and I don't know, I don't want to de-evergreen your show here. It's worth noting that we're talking on July 1st. I will say this. If you have anxiety around the virus, you likely have the proper anxiety around your personal economy. If you are dismissive of the virus, if you're dismissive of your role in preventing the spread of the virus, you are unlikely, in my estimation, to understand the economic impact that the virus and its consequences will have on your life.
Is part of your job keeping them from freaking out?
I'm an action guy, right? So I do view that our role is to talk people down from their stock market anxiety. You know, we're going to help them understand, you know, statistics and, you know, history. But when it comes to the economy, I feel like so many of us just want things to go back to normal, that it's possible to focus that into a manifestation, and that manifestation is action. I'm going to cut my spending. I'm going to pay attention. I'm going to press reset on my financial life. I'm going to stop guessing, which I think is one of the biggest ills of comfort, is when people just assume they're fine or they assume they're bad. But when it boils down to it, you got to know. You can't guess. And so anxiety is creeping back up. I feel like people were bored from mid-April till the second week of June. They became comfortable with the new normal. They found complacency in discomfort. And I think it's about to get rocked. I also, you know, I've read some pieces recently that upwards of 20% of people who take Paycheck Protection Program funds, those are small businesses who, you know, sought government assistance, that once those funds are exhausted, which is right now, this is when they're running out, is right now as we speak, they will lay off folks. So I think you could theoretically see an uptick in unemployment here in the next 3 or 4 weeks.
Wow, now I'm scared.
Well, no, and look, here, let's go to my own personal anxiety, because I didn't really answer that. I am seeing, from our business standpoint and from other small business owners that I talk to on a pretty regular basis and large business owners, Q3 looks like it could be a rather normal quarter, all things considered. Which is
really
crazy.
Normal
in the face of everything I've just said. Restaurants aren't going to be normal. Bars aren't going to be normal. The hotel business and travel industries aren't going to be normal. But a lot of business-to-business services absolutely are going to get closer to their numbers. If they took a 50% hit, if they missed their numbers by a 50% marker over previous year, I think they're going to be closer to come within 20%, 10% of their previous third quarter goals. I'll just tell you, I mean, from that perspective, that is what gives me hope, is that the economy does feel like it may roar back in terms of pent-up demand. But we got to get the virus under control, because if we keep slingshotting back and forth, open and closed, the government does not have enough money, can't print enough money to keep everyone afloat.
Well, yeah, that's really the existential crisis, isn't it? I mean, we're not seeing anybody who suggests, I mean, beyond maybe one or two extremely rose-colored characters, that we're going to have a vaccine within a year.
I think it's just adjusting. And that's what makes me nervous about the lack of government assistance that theoretically should have happened within the last 4 weeks. I think there should have been another stimulus package in the last 3 or 4 weeks. But what we're hearing is Congress is saying, well, let's wait, you know, the Senate specifically, let's wait and see so we know where that money is needed. I think it could be, and don't get me wrong, I like more information. I like the prudence of more information. But I think what we're going to see is that waiting will have cost a lot of people financially. I think we need to get more money into the hands of people in a direct payment. I think unemployment will unemployment enhancement of $600 a week should likely be extended. Whether I agree with that politically and the philosophy of people not working and being compensated, I just don't think the jobs are going to come back fast enough. It's you're going to have a glut of unemployed people with no money and no jobs to, you know, coax them back. That worries me a bit.
Now, 4 months ago, and you have been referring to this off and on during this conversation, you said one of the strategies to surviving this is getting lean. And so you give people, you know, that message, trim out all the fat. Do people seriously take you up on that advice? Are you seeing that happen?
If the question is, do people listen to me? The answer is no. I like that we're talking about getting lean and we're looking at each other through Zoom and I look like a guy who ate me. Like I have not gotten lean over the last 16 weeks since we've talked. Yeah. You know what? Oddly enough, and this is not a self-serving answer, people have listened. We have seen a lot of people really change their habits. And here's how they did it, actually. If you looked at your bank statement in January of 2020, you will have seen your normal spending. You know, that's just who you are and what you normally do. And then you look at your bank statement in April, when you weren't allowed to spend any money, when you were too scared to spend any money, you couldn't go anywhere, nothing was open. Look at those two numbers, man. Not only look at the discretionary spending, but look at the frequency of which you were spending money. People typically spend money 3 to 4 times a day during normal times. People were spending money 4 times a week in April of 2020. So people were forced to change. And Mason, what happened is people just held on to that. They said, yeah, this stinks, but it's not that bad. I think we can make this work until we know more. And so I think a lot of people held on to that. I'll tell you this, I have stability, but even Mrs. Planner and I found comfort in trying to save more money during that period of time. Saving money is not a greedy thing. It's not a fearful thing. It's a comforting thing. It can mean that you're in control and you feel like you control what is next. And so I think a lot of people fell back in love with that idea.
Isn't there some kind of cognitive dissonance though there? Because certain rose-colored people and other politicians really, really want you to go out and spend money.
So I love this point, right? Because the first stimulus plan that put money in the pockets of people with the stimulus payments, it wasn't a stimulus plan. I mean, by definition, it was a survival mechanism. It was these people are starving. There was never this idea, there shouldn't have been the idea that, oh, you know what? Go get landscaping with this money or go get manscaping, whatever. Any
escaping you want. I did both of those.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone does. Now, the next round, theoretically, I think that's what they were hoping would happen, that you could load a debit card or prepaid card and use it to spend money and you can't cash it out. I mean, a lot of those things are being talked about. But look, I think cautious and prudent people look at what's going on. They see the spike in virus infections. They see unemployment increase, and they don't feel like pumping money into local retail makes as much sense as making sure the family can survive the year with the unknown. And that's especially true for a population, which again is the readership of IBJ, where it is likely that they have incentive compensation that will not be there for them as the year goes on.
Let me talk about a couple of scenarios that are probably on the minds of people who read IBJ. One is paying for college. What are clients saying about either keeping their kids in college or sending them this year?
A couple things to consider. Number one, if it's going to be virtual, to pay top dollar for a virtual education, in spite of my relationships with several higher ed institutions. Yeah, it's just not the same experience. So I think you're going to see a lot of first year students and their parents make the tough decision to say, if I'm going virtual, let's just go virtual at a lower cost and make sure that those credits will transfer when the world normalizes once again. So there's that. Number two, the Wall Street Journal had an article at the end of June that talked about more and more students are simply calling up and bargaining. They're just calling up the financial office at their higher ed institution and they're saying, can't do $35,000 a year. Would you take $22,500? Like, and it's happening and it's working. And so, Mason, I think this is one of those situations where people are saying, well, we want campuses to be open, so we're going to say campuses are open. And if you want to come here, you've got to pay top dollar and be part of the open situation. I am the parent of a sixth grader and a third grader, so I don't have the same emotions that someone who's the parent of a just going into 13th grade might have. I don't know. I think we're going to need at least 3-4 more weeks before we really understand what's happening there. You've already got a lot of talk about fall sports being canceled, not only in higher ed, but in a high school level too. And I think that plays into it as well, because it is culturally part of the college experience.
You know, what about folks who have kids in private school? I mean, that's not cheap either.
You know, it's funny. I actually haven't thought about that. I would assume you're going to see some people struggle there. If I'm saying that 65% of Americans are in group two, which means has not lost income, but theoretically is on the verge because they don't have stability and they can't deal with a lot of adversity. It's not like people who send their kids to private school are all in group three. There's a lot in group two. So I think you are going to see some impact there. you know, a lot of people live very, very comfortable financial lives without them ever being stable. And there's a lot of people who are stable who live less comfortably. I mean, it's the classic millionaire next door sort of idea there. And so I think those two groups are kind of looking at each other in a little bit of a mirror situation, trying to figure out who's who of who really is stable and who has always just looked stable.
How about folks who have either just retired or were expecting to retire in the next year or so?
You know, my thoughts on this have evolved since our discussion on March 12th. I was terrified for the people who had just retired because of sequence of return risk. That's the idea that, you know, the market's going to go up and down. But if you retire and it starts going down as you start, it depletes capital and your ability to generate retirement income. And that's like one of the worst things that can happen to you financially. So I was worried about that. But that sort of has leveled itself off as long as people didn't overreact. You also begin to worry about, is someone going to retire with a pension? And what's the health of corporate pensions right now going forward? So I don't know. I've become more positive about people who have just retired and are thinking about retiring and their outlook than I was on March 12th. I have to admit, I remember being in my office that day and you and I talk, and I just remember the vibe. I've gotten a lot more optimistic since that day. And you started our interview by saying I was right about some things. I certainly was, but in many other respects, I think some of my predictions have yet to shake out.
Mm. Well, yeah, I think one of the things you thought might happen is people might need to unretire.
I did think that. And where my where I think I'm wrong on that is that the jobs won't be there for them to unretire.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. You put together these hypotheses and you just work through them, but then you forget things like, well, hey, they're going to run out of money. They need to unretire. Well, that's not really going to be an option. I don't think. I still think GDP is up in Q3. I think it is up in Q4.
When you say up, you mean positive or do you mean just better than the last desultory quarter?
I think positive in the fourth quarter and certainly way up from the second quarter here in the third quarter. The average recession in our country lasts 11 months. And reports are that our recession actually went into effect, I don't know if that's the way you would say it, in February of 2020. So if it's the average, we're done by the end of the year and we're rip-roaring again in January. The Great Recession, 2008 and 2009, is really a bit of a misnomer because it started in 2007 and it was 18 months long. So if you think about those of us that remember 2008 and 2009 and how we felt and all of that, most of us didn't realize we were in trouble for the first 12 months of that silly thing. You know what I mean? That's what's different about this is there was only 1 month of this where people didn't know we were in trouble, where it was legitimately, not 12, I'd say 9 months of the Great Recession where all of us were sort of aloof until October or so of 2008.
Okay, so today is July 1st. We are exactly halfway through the year. What one or two things should we all be doing to finish up the second half?
All right, I'm just going to go through the groups because it's just the cleanest way to look through this. If you're in group one, it's about survival. And it's really about this concept we've been trying to help people with. It's that when things are really bad, you're really just trying to get through the day, right? I mean, you just are trying to survive. But it's so important to sort of timeline out what a month or 3 months looks like without being defeatist, without going, oh, well, nothing's going to change. You almost have to give yourself options to say, okay, well, unemployment's changing, but my job should be coming back, and then this will be coming. You really have to map out 1 to 3 months if you're in group one. So often you're just battling the next thing in front of you and you get tunnel vision and you can get in trouble. So that's group one. Group two, do not pay down debt. Just make minimum payments. Your main goal is to stack money in your emergency fund. That's all I care about if you're in group two, is to re-examine your spending, get to 3 months expenses. For some people, it's easier than they think because they're just making discretionary spending changes. Some people are using this opportunity of, are we working, are we not working, to go on the vacation that they always go on, risky or otherwise. And other people are saying, look, these are unprecedented times. We're not going to spend the money on a vacation. We're going to set that money to the side and create more stability. So that's group two. Group three, very frankly, business as usual. If you're in group three, you are investing as much as you ever were, if not more. You are paying down debt at the same level if you happen to have any. and you're looking for opportunities to buy low and sell high without getting greedy, because you, this sounds gross, you earned the right to do that with your stability.
30 seconds.
Yep.
What surprised you the most about the last 4 months?
I think employers have done a great job of trying to save jobs. I feel like they did things like cut 401k matches, they cut some hours, they cut some other benefits, but they did it so they didn't have to lay off whole people. And I feel like small business owners, large business owners, corporate America, in my opinion, has really looked out for their workers more than I thought was possible.
Okay, well, when should we check in next?
What are you doing next Tuesday? No, I don't know. I will say we'll know
more. We redid our deck. You can come over here and we can talk to each other from 24 feet across.
I'd say the end of August, we're going to know everything we need to know for the rest of the year.
Okay. All right. Let's do it. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
No, my pleasure. Good to talk with you again.
My thanks again to Pete Dunn. Before you get on with the rest of your week, there are a few stories in the latest issue of IBJ that I want to point out. Kirk Christian has the latest on the road work underway along State Road 37 in Hamilton County, which officials already estimate will go $47 million over budget. The kicker is that local residents will be responsible for picking up the cost of the overruns. Now, wouldn't it be nice if he didn't have to drive through construction zones? While it might be many years before fully autonomous, no-driver-required vehicles are common, transportation officials in Indiana and Ohio are laying the groundwork. Susan Orr reports that the states have received grants to study and advance the use of semi-autonomous trucks traveling on I-70 between Indianapolis and Columbus. And Anthony Shetley has a little ditty about the local music instruction company, Piano in a Flash, which recently saw its revenue more than triple, practically overnight. You might know Scott Houston from the PBS show The Piano Guy, but it took a pandemic to push the popularity of his online lessons to new heights. And again, you can read these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at ibj.com. I will say, it's quite a bit easier to access the stories if you have a subscription, which costs less than a cup of coffee per week. If you're interested, just go to the website and click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbenner. I'm Mason King, and we'll be back again next week.